I will call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water for Thursday, March 10th. We will move in the following order. We'll actually start with a work session on 3157 while we have members, at least most of our members here. We will move then to Representative Wisnett to present on 2827, and I think we'll do the rest of that public hearing, then on to 3314, and then 3203. So that's the order that we'll plan to take them in, and let me open a work session on 3157. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to the thorough vetting and the positive response by the committee to House Bill 3157, I move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilliam moves House Bill 3157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative
Benz?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Excused.
Representative
Witt? Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
And with that, the motion carries. House Bill 3157 will go to the floor. Does anybody want to carry this bill?
Mr. Chairman,
as
someone who had a former bill that dealt with this topic, I'd be pleased to carry
that. Great. Thank you. Representative Witt will carry House Bill 3157 to the floor. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3157 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2827. Representative Wisnett.
Chairs, honorable committee members, good afternoon. For the record, I am Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Thank you very much for hearing House Bill 2827, which repeals the sunset of provisions permitting sales of diesel fuel containing additives. Members, this is a very important bill to my district and its citizens and some of our economy. Let me explain how it affected my district greatly in December 2009. Three different organizations could not start some of their diesel vehicles. The Lapine school buses were, they closed the school for 3 days. Everhart Dairy in Redmond could not start their diesel vehicles. Ben garbage and recycling trucks could not start their trucks. As I said, Lapine had to cancel school for 3 days because they couldn't get their buses to run. The dairy could not make deliveries, and some of the garbage trucks would not start. I'm not an expert on this. You're going to get testimony from Mr. Romaine and Mr. Russell, I think. But I've worked with them both to on the languages of this bill, to take away the sunset on the bill, which was passed last session in the special session, and to allow diesel to be sold that has had additive substance to prevent the gelling, congealing of the diesel to be sold between the months of October and February. This would make sure that the diesel would not gel in very cold weather, and the schools in these organizations would still be able to have their vehicles during the inclement weather. I do want to compliment Representative Cannon for his support of House Bill 3693 in the 2010 special session, which gave us the opportunity to develop a solution to this issue, and I would urge the committee to pass this bill for the safety and services of our citizens throughout this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Wisnett. Are there any questions? Representative Witt.
Not too technical now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wisnett, I asked this question out of ignorance, and so I do not expect necessarily you to have this answer, but perhaps committee staff or anyone else. But do we, as a matter of public policy, would we typically prevent the selling of additives that would make it possible for folks to use diesel fuel in the middle of bitter winter and sub-zero temperatures?
Right. Thank Mr. Chairs and Representative Witt. Thank you for the question. I think I do know that one. What it was, it's the two, you know, we had to have 2% biodiesel,
yes,
and we had to have 5% starting this year, I think, 5%.
Yes.
And when you add the additive, it changes those ratios.
Changes the percentages.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
Hey,
I got that right. Thank you very much.
Great. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do we have additional testimony from the department on this?
I am looking for our sign-up sheets, and I'm not seeing them.
They're
so
there.
I suspect we will get additional testimony. Around the room. Yeah. I think the answer is yes. You have a question for Representative Wisnip?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative, thanks for bringing this forward. I'm curious. You may have the answer to this. It may be the department. It may be folks coming later. But just to throw the question out, I recall when we discussed this bill in this committee previously and the one-year trial period, I believe that there was to be some it was a test period, and there was to be some reporting back on the effectiveness, the cost, how often it was used, those sorts of data and metrics. I don't know if you have that information or if the department does, but I'd be interested in the results of that.
Thank you, Chairs and Representative Bailey. Thank you for the question. I think Mr. Romaine has some of that data, and it was tested and what we've come up with, and he can present that data to you. You will be able to get the answers to that question. I think.
And I'm noting that the Department of Ag is here and is available to testify if we have particular questions for the department.
Thank you. That should have been in my testimony. I guess I omitted that, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Department of Agriculture has agreed to this, what they came up with.
Great. Well, thanks for bringing this bill back. Clearly, an issue we want to make sure does not arise in subsequent.
Well, again, as I said, Chair, we thank you for your leadership in this in the past. It allowed us to keep our buses running and our businesses operating. We do get very extreme calls over there, and it did create an issue that we hadn't foreseen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Romaine and Bob Russell. Let's hear from you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. Go on record, too.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations.
I'm in support. We're both in support of House Bill 2827. Basically, what we found during this last winter is it worked, that the ability to add, when necessary, diesel number one or other additives worked, and it kept engines from having problems. This is not an option that the industry likes to have or likes to use, frankly, because it's more expensive than just not adding anything to the fuel. So if the fuel works or if the temperature's right or if it's blended correctly or whatever the science is, it's not used. It's just more expensive. So having it as an option, what we did was we went through a colder winter than we had in 2009, and we didn't have any problems. So I don't have any – there's no empirical data, but we just didn't have any complaints this time.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So help me understand – was it added to the fuel stream for the entire period? Was it added at different points? How was the program implemented and used?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I think each company kind of makes their own judgment call on when they're going to add it, basically. They make some calls about what the weather's going to be like and what they're going to put in their tank. So it varies.
Oh.
So then potentially we might have some differential on when it was added and when it wasn't. Did we have gelling or did we not? Based on those different periods within that time frame?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we didn't have any complaints this winter. So, I mean, whenever they were adding it, they seemed to be adding it at the right time if they were adding it. Either that or it's being blended better. We're not sure what it is. All we know is that we've worked with the Department of Ag. They think it's fine. Our folks know it works. And we did not run into any problems with it. That's why we're asking you to remove the sunset. Again, it's an expensive thing to do. It's not something that we're going to be doing if it's not necessary. And it also keeps Representative Jensen from having to pour his scotch into the truck of his car or in the tank of his car to get the thing going.
Thank you. Well, I'm all in favor of protecting Representative Jensen's scotch. I guess what I'm trying to get at with these questions is. As I believe you mentioned in the testimony last time and as you're repeating now, My understanding is the blending, as you say, is more expensive in order to prevent this gelling, and so it wouldn't be used very often. And so I'm trying to get some sort of measure of, well, if it's only used when it's really needed, how often is it being used? Is everybody using it in kind of the same ways? And are there some trade-offs? I'm trying to evaluate sort of the veracity of, are people only using this when it's absolutely necessary, or is there sort of this risk aversion that people are adding it sort of all the time because they're placing such a high value on what they think is the probability or possibility of seizing occurring?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the answer to that question, but Mr. Russell seems to be antsy.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, maybe I can help a little bit. I've checked with my members in Eastern Oregon, and as you recall from the previous testimony, most of the problems occurred in Eastern Oregon in 2009, which led to the passage of 3693 in February of 2010. And they are all using additives. We limited the months in which they could do that because they're all getting bulk deliveries of fuel. So we front-loaded it so they could start getting the fuel in October, and then it stops in February, and that delivery they get at the end of February will last them through the rest of the cold season. What I found is that they were using different types of additives. There are chemical additives, and there is also the diesel number one, which dilutes the biodiesel, and they're using all of that. And they all reported Hermiston, Umatilla, and Baker City, even though we have had significant cold weather, that they did not have any problems. They kept the trucks running. And contrast that to when they were shut down in 2009. And one member reported to me back then that he had an above-ground storage tank, and he couldn't figure out why the fuel wouldn't come out. So he took a stick, which is how you normally measure the level of fuel inside the tank, put it in there. When he pulled it out, had this big glop of biodiesel on the bottom, which had clearly congealed. I talked to that person this week to make sure that they didn't have any further problems, and they don't. From our perspective, April 1st, we go from 2% to 5%. And if we don't maintain this ability to add the additives to make sure that we don't have the problem, it's going to be worse than it was in 2009 because the concentration of biodiesel is higher. So we strongly urge the committee to look favorably upon this bill. And again, I'd like to thank Representative Cannon for taking the leadership back in 2010 and hope that we will continue this policy permanently.
Did you have any other testimony, Mr. Russell?
I would be happy to answer questions, or I can provide testimony if you'd like me to provide testimony, but I think that all I would be doing is repeating what Paul and I have already said.
Great. Any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think it would be helpful to hear even briefly from the Department of Ag. I know you're not here with prepared testimony on this issue, but you know, I'd be interested in hearing what experiences, if any, you had related to this issue this winter.
Co-Chair Cannon, committee members. My name is Jason Barber, Administrator with the Measurement Standards Division with Department of Agriculture.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Page, and I'm Renewable Energy Specialist with Oregon Department of Agriculture.
So as was mentioned back last winter, we received approximately 20 complaints the winter around December 10th regarding V2 blends gelling in eastern, central and eastern Oregon. As a result of that, in February, the special session, this bill was put into place. This winter, we have received one gelling complaint that came a couple weeks ago from a farmer, I think, outside of Baker. So it has been a great improvement.
Are there any questions for the department? Can you describing this. This begins to get a little technical and back into the conversations we had last year when we worked on it initially. But what would be the impacts without this provision? Let's say fuel is sold that is, or biodiesel is sold that is blended at 5%. Once additives become part of the mix, what is that? How does the percentage reduce? That's the concern that the bill tries to address.
Yeah, Chair Cannon, it really depends on the retailer and the wholesaler of the fuel. They basically will order it down to whatever temperature they think they need. So again, in different areas of Eastern Oregon, they're tracking the weather patterns. If they feel that some major cold spills are coming, they may order fuel from their wholesaler to a minus 20, 30 degrees. So if that's the case, then certainly the additives would be greater. So it really is hard to track statewide or even east of the Cascades just exactly how much additives are being added because it varies.
Can you give a sense? I guess what I'm looking for is once those additives are part of the blend in a particular tank, what is that biodiesel percentage? It was 5%. Now there are additives. Is it 2% or is it 4.9% biodiesel?
Sure, Ken. I think it depends on what they want to winterize it to. It could be anywhere from 4% to 2%, maybe even lower than that. If I'm understanding your question.
Maybe I'm not phrasing it correctly, or maybe I'm learning something new. But my impression was that the wholesaler sells the biodiesel according to the state standard, renewable fuel standard, which is now for 5%. So the tank...
April 1st, it'll be 5%.
So the tank is... The wholesaler is selling at 5%. Then some additives are splashed in, I think, is sometimes...
Splash blending, or if they're actually ordering it from a terminal, it could be injection blending.
Okay. So even those words, at least splash, for me... paints the picture of a little bit by quantity, a little bit of additive, which will have the effect of reducing the percentage of the fuel that is biodiesel. It was 5%. What is it once those additives are part of the overall mix?
Mm-hmm. Chair Cannon, I think we don't know the answer to that question. We haven't collected information from the retailers about how the additives affect the final blend. We did attend a biodiesel blending conference that was put on this summer by the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association, and probably some of the presenters from that conference who were talking about best practices could offer a better answer than we could.
Okay, and it appears that there may be other folks who can mm-hmm. answer the question somewhat more precisely, but the concern, mm-hmm. at least for me, is that the intention of the 5% biodiesel standard is to ensure that fuel that's sold in the state is 5% biodiesel to create a market for Oregon agricultural products and Oregon biodiesel, as well as biodiesel coming from elsewhere. And if we have the effect under this proposal of reducing the amount of biodiesel that's sold in Oregon, we ought to know that. And that's what I'm trying to get at. Mr. Russell, do you want to come up and address this? And you stay up here because there may be other questions.
Mm-hmm. Again, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Maybe I wasn't clear when I testified before, but there's a couple of different ways of doing this. One way is with a chemical additive, and then you're right, the sort of the concept of the splash is correct. It's a very small amount. And the other way of doing it is by blending diesel number 1 with diesel number 2 that includes the bio. That is much different and reduces the percentage much more significantly. I have never seen anybody add more than 50% of number one to number two. And that's the traditional way that we've avoided the gelling in the wintertime. So at most, you're going to have 2.5%. I mean, at least, that's the least amount of biodiesel that you will have. And again, Mr. Romaine, when he testified, he said that this is very expensive. Diesel number one costs a whole lot more than diesel number two, and the chemical additives are also very expensive. So we're not going to do it or pay for it unless we need it. And from our experience so far, I mean, this has been a central and eastern Oregon issue. And talking with my members that have experienced the problem in 09 and not experienced it this winter, they really need the flexibility of being able to do this. And they do it two different ways, one with the chemicals and one with diesel number one.
Thank you. Thank you. Two words. Maybe 20.
Mr. Chair, Paul Romaine again. I realize the committee's concern is 5% biodiesel or 2% biodiesel. But in the real world out there, the concern of the petroleum industry and those who provide fuel is making sure that the vehicle we put the fuel in will work. So our concern, and believe me, cost is a big factor in this stuff, but our major concern is that where we sell the fuel to, that fuel will actually work in the temperature where they are. And so we will blend down to, if necessary, 50%. If they're using a diesel number one, again, very expensive. You don't want to do that. An additive, cheaper, may work. But the concern, we cannot have an ambulance or a school bus or a fire truck or a garbage truck or anybody else's car freezing up, and that's our concern.
Representative, Mr. Romaine, I can assure you.
I won't take it.
Go to Representative Bailey next. I can assure you that the committee's concern is also to make sure that cars and vehicles, particularly emergency vehicles and school buses, stay on the road.
Right.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for your indulgence of lots of questions. Perhaps this is a rudimentary question, and I can take the answer offline. When one blends diesel 1 into a fuel stream at a particular amount or one of these other chemical additives, are there effects on emissions, on particles that come out? Or what does that do to the fuel and to the other things that we care about that we're regulating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I'm really not an expert in that area. I know that diesel blending has been going on for a lot longer than we've had biodiesel around.
Mm-hmm.
So I know it's used in the winter months. I don't believe it has any effect, but again, maybe Mr. Russell knows more than I do on this area.
Any other questions? Great. Any questions for the department? Well, they're here. If not, I did want to, I invited council up, so thank you. I invited Legislative Council up just to explain quickly and why this bill was drafted the way it was. Sure, there's a very good reason. We think it's so easy. We just repeal a sunset. That should take one line, and of course, that's not the way it looks.
No, Chair Cannon and Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, I'm Melissa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I drafted this bill. Section 1 repeals the section of the 2010 law that would have ended the additive exception. And Section 2 makes it a part of our permanent law to allow the additive exception. Section 3, there are sometimes multiple versions of a statute that come into effect at different times. Section 3 is a version of ORS 646-922 that I believe is going to come into effect in 2012 that would add other renewable diesel to the statute. And so it therefore also had to have this additive exception added to it. Section 4 is probably the mind-boggling one. This simply provides that if this act does not become effective until after the repeal date of March 1st of this year, which of course it won't because that date's already passed, it operates retroactively once it does become effective, so that the law stands with an additive exception from March 1st of this year on. And then Section 5 declares an emergency.
Okay. Any questions? I just want to confirm that I'm understanding it. The effect of passing this bill, if this bill goes into law, will be that the provisions of the law allowing the blending come into effect, back into effect, on October 1st of this year. So October 1st, 2011 through February 28th, 2012, it will be possible to blend even if the fuel ultimately isn't then at the 5% standard, and that will be true then for subsequent years as well.
That is correct, Chair Cannon.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
No other questions. Well, with that, I think it may be possible to bring all of our members into a supportive posture for this bill, but it may require a couple more days. And so I'm going to suggest that we hold off on today's work session, get this reposted, work with the members to make it happen. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2827, and we will move on to Representative Holvey and open House Bill 3314, public hearing. Representative Holvey.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me an opportunity to speak today. I am State Representative Paul Holvey. I serve District 8. This afternoon, I'm bringing forward to you a bill, House Bill 3314, with a -2 amendment, and asking for your consideration of this bill. This bill deals with transgenic fish specifically, and we'll go on a little bit on that. I'm sure there's some people that may be able to define it a little bit better than I, but it's basically a fish that's been genetically engineered. The creation and development of genetically engineered fish, as seen with the introduction of triploid salmon species, poses a risk for wild stock in Oregon. The threat of native species being declared endangered has great environmental and economic impacts. Should genetically engineered fish be introduced into the wild and occupy wild salmon's natural habitat, they will be competing for food and space while potentially depleting populations of wild salmon. Certainly there's been some problems with this in other parts of the country and in other parts of the world. British Columbia, Norway, and Scotland have all had issues resulting from hatchery fish that are genetically engineered and have had negative impacts on their wild populations. Genetically engineered fish, these triploid are actually sterile, but from conversations I've had, they do try to breed, and they generally are very much larger and can sort of beat up on the natural stock, something that is That's what I've been told. I haven't seen any science on that one particularly, but that's what I have been told. Certainly, this is particularly alarming, and the fact that genetically engineered fish would be difficult, perhaps even impossible to eradicate, they're really very similar to having an invasive species. And because these genetically engineered organisms are usually modified so as to enable them to withstand wider ranges of salinity or temperature, they also pose a threat to wild stock because the wild stock won't be quite as resistant to some of the diseases that these fish could pass on if they are in our state waters or in the wild. So the solution to this problem is basically to prohibit, contained in this bill, and I'm sure you've looked at it a little bit. And it does include shellfish. One of the concerns I had with shellfish was essentially crab. I don't know that there is any genetically engineered crab at this point, but it was something I was thinking about in the future. I hadn't even considered that there may be some impacts to industry currently in Oregon. I got a letter from Oregon State University talking about oysters. I was unaware that we had genetically engineered oyster farms in the state. Not near as worried about them swimming around, and would certainly entertain an amendment to perhaps provide an exemption to them if there is no particular danger from the oysters. So that I would probably clam up on that particular. Part of the bill, and would seek another amendment to accomplish that. I really appreciate this time talking about this issue. I really am seriously concerned about what's happened in other places with genetically engineered fish. The Food and Drug Administration is now looking at authorizing genetically engineered fish to be farmed and released, and there's talks about it in the Atlantic Ocean. That are becoming a big problem, and we certainly have Atlantic salmon in the Pacific now, and those are of great concerns to our natural stock. And when we have problems around this state with having species declared endangered, it seems like we should not be introducing species that basically kill or compete with the natural stock. So with that, I'll close. That was my pretty basic statement about this. I'm sure there's others that may talk a little bit more scientifically about it. It took a little bit of time to research this and try to figure out what recombinant DNA was and triploid fish, and so it's a different world out there. And I guess just speak to them as most people know them as Frankenfish. And, it sounds sort of funny, but this is really a potential serious threat to our environment and our natural fish. So I hope you take this bill and give it some good consideration. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Any questions? Great. You're excused.
Mr. Chair,
I have
a question, actually. What, the Any Waters piece, I actually could look up 506-006, but Any Waters, can you just tell us what that is? Any Waters of the state, is that a...
That's
like it sounds.
It is. It's there's basically publicly owned waters.
Which would be all, follow-up. Both. That would be irrigation canal, a fish hatchery, a Any Waters.
As long as they're, I guess, attached to publicly owned, like rivers, and I mean that's really the aim of it. The ocean going out to our limit, which I think is about 3 miles or something like that. A lot of the coastal caucuses sitting on this panel, they probably know this better than I. But that's my understanding. It's just public waters essentially.
Follow up. I was just trying to see if the water at Oregon State University. In the university buildings, swimming pool, whatever they raise their fish in, is classified as Any Waters. And
it's my understanding they are not under that definition.
I will seek a clarification on that because this bill is not meant to impact research and those sorts of things as long as the waters are not part of what we generally think of our river systems and the oceans.
As long as they're navigable, that's probably what you're saying. I'm joking.
Do you really want to go there? And there is a provision, I don't think affected by the Dash 2 amendment, that says that the bill doesn't apply to genetically engineered fish or shellfish that are used for scientific research in an aquarium or other similar closed water system, which may help them. Representative Thompson, do you have a question?
So if, I think you may have answered my question, but if I'm growing fish for the fresh market in an isolated spring not connected to a river, that would be permitted?
Well, that's my understanding, but if you're on private property doing that, this bill doesn't impact you.
Okay. And I want to know where these larger fish are that you refer to. My grandson and I look for them. We haven't been able to find any. So
yeah.
If you know a spot, I'd like to know.
It's probably what you're using for bait.
Probably.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Appreciate the bill, the testimony. Let's hear from some other folks. We'll bring two panels of three up, starting with Jim Myram, Tom Wolf, and Mark Weigert.
Weigert,
sorry.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. I think you have my testimony already electronically, I believe. We support this bill. In fact, this bill actually builds on a policy that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife developed probably 15 years or so ago now, at the encouragement and with the encouragement and assistance of Bill Bakke from the Native Fish Society. I've reprinted the policy out of the administrative rules in the middle of the comments there. The existing policy is that the department shall consider the releases of transgenic fish to pose a serious risk to wild populations, and the department shall not authorize the release of transgenic fish into locations where such fish may gain access to wild fish populations. So that's been in place for a number of years. We see the proposed bill as a good follow-on to that existing policy because it expands the scope of the policy to include transportation, importation, cultivation, incubation, and disposal. The Dash 2 amendments were suggested by our organization as a way to close a potential loophole in the section of the bill that allows for that scientific research exemption. And the Dash 2 amendments would just simply assure that any fish used in those research projects would be disposed of properly. We've had some instances in the state of Oregon, particularly with some crawfish that some of the schools use for some of their science programs, and rather than killing the crawfish when they're done, they just take them down to the local stream and dump them in. And right now, the Lower John Day River has got quite a population of introduced exotic crawfish from the Midwest, even though the supplier of those crawfish were warned by the Department of Fish and Wildlife that it was illegal to import them or send them to the state. So we're hopeful that this additional statutory prohibition will help to resolve that problem and keep these genetically modified organisms from being imported and spread throughout the state. So be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Mr. Wolf.
Co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, the 2,800 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state of Oregon. And we come to support this bill because we think it addresses a very serious problem of the introduction of transgenic fish
commonly called Frankenfish, which is meant to import some sort of scare tactic, and it is very scary. Currently, there is on there's an action alert out to the 150,000 members of TU nationally, asking them to write letters to FDA get FDA to deny the release of a permit that would allow the introduction of aqua company to grow these frankenfish, because as it was referred to earlier, you know, in along the Pacific coast there are many cases where they grow Atlantic salmon, farmed Atlantic salmon, which are not native to our coast or even of a different genus, along here in large numbers, especially up in BC and in parts of Puget Sounds. And they have actually, no matter the safeguards, they have escaped from those net pens that are causing serious competition problems with native wild salmon. If you allow transgenic fish to exist, there's a very real chance they could be raised in net pens out here on the Pacific coast and cause the same problems of escaping into the wild, because no matter how carefully you try to stop this from happening, safeguards always fail. So we urge you to support this bill. We think it's a very good bill, and we particularly like the Dash 2 amendments. And that's the end of my testimony. Thank you very much.
Great. Representative Krieger.
Tell me what a triple white is.
Co-chairs and members, Representative Krieger, I'm not an expert, but it's my understanding that a triploid is a sterile fish, and I don't know if that falls under the construct of this bill or not, because I don't believe triploids have been genetically modified. They've just simply been made sterile.
Any other questions?
Excuse me. Do you know how they achieve it? How that fish achieves that condition?
How it becomes a triploid?
Yeah, what do they do to the egg or to the parent?
I believe that they heat the eggs while they're incubating, which creates the fish that's growing in the egg. It makes it sterile.
Then if they're sterile and they're put in our lakes or streams, how would they have a negative effect on wild fish?
I don't think they would. I don't think the intent of this bill, and I could be incorrect, but I don't think the intent was to eliminate triploids. It's to get at genetically modified organisms, and maybe the department has a better answer of what triploids are, but I don't think they're genetically modified.
Mr. Chair, when we get other people up,
we'll pursue that with other folks. Mr. Weiger, do you want to come on up?
Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gillian and the rest of the committee members, my name is Mark Weigert. I'm co-owner of Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery in Neatarts Bay, Oregon, and the reason I'm here today is the length, and I'm going to only speak specifically of shellfish. I am not here to comment on trout or salmon or anything like that. And Representative Krieger, just getting back to your question, what is a triploid? If you go into any supermarket now and you find any fruit that has no seeds, like seedless watermelons, I mean, I think even bananas, even grapes, if you notice, all these fruits look a little different. Plus, your grapes are bigger now, and those are actually triploids. And what triploids do in the food world is they create a bigger product, a faster growing product. I don't know if they're any cheaper, but it's kind of driven towards a consumer. So a simple answer: what is a triploid? Whether it's fish or fruit or anything else, it just simply lacks seeds or the ability to reproduce. And what we do at Whiskey Creek Shellfish is we produce larvae anywhere from 7 to 10 billion larvae, shellfish larvae, a year for the West Coast farms all the way down to Mexico and to Canada. Sometimes we do international, but we've been actively producing triploid larvae, oyster larvae, for at least 10 years now. And of course, the language in this, and the thing that I came with today, and I think it's in your folder, is something that was submitted by Chris Langdon of Oregon State. And we've been producing these for 10 years, and the reason we do it is because when you go into the supermarket in the summertime and you buy a jar of oysters, you probably don't know it, but you're probably buying a triploid oyster. And the reason is the consumer does not want an oyster that has a developed gonad. They actually get milky. They're just not as good. And so we provide, I say, 40% of our production to triploids because it actually fills that summer market. And everybody said, well, you know, I get two questions in the shellfish business. Why don't you eat oysters in the month of R, and do you get pearls? Well, one, we don't get pearls, or I wouldn't be raising larvae. you can eat oysters, with the month of R, because now we have triploids. And the simple fact is, and I don't want to jump over onto the trout side of things, but triploids cannot reproduce. They simply cannot reproduce. And the way we make triploids is we actually take a diploid, which is a regular set of chromosomes, and we cross it with a tetraploid. And so tetraploid has two sets of chromosomes, actually four, and the diploid only has two. And so what you end up with three when you cross them. And these things, these triploids, again, they cannot reproduce in the wild. They're simply there for the farmers to fill a gap in their production. And yes, they do get a little bit bigger. They grow a little bit faster. I heard some comments referring to trout getting or fish getting a little bit bigger, a little bit faster, which is true in the shellfish world. But at the end, these strains of triploids in the shellfish world are not as hardy as the diploids. And usually, if you don't sell them in the first 2 to 3 years, they will die. They just seem to kind of run. They run off the edge of the cliff. They have a higher metabolism. I can't speak scientifically as to what salmon would do in the environment, but I'm pretty sure that a triploid salmon, they cannot reproduce in the wild. Genetically, they cannot do it. There was reference that they try to reproduce. Well, maybe they're like steers. I don't know. I'm here to say is if there's any way we can omit this language in this bill in regards to shellfish, it would severely cut our production, maybe up to 50%, if in fact we were not allowed to produce triploids for the shellfish growers on the West Coast.
Mr. Weigert, appreciate your testimony and making the trip over to the Capitol today. Thank you. Are there questions, Representative Boone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Mark. Yeah. Mark's my constituent, and I spoke with Representative Holvey outside the room before this bill came up, and it reiterated to me he had not considered the shellfish angle, and he's more than happy to, I can't speak for him, but he indicated he was more than happy to take the shellfish piece out of this particular bill. Because he had no intention of doing what you have.
Yeah, and I completely understand, you know, the invasive species angle and everything else. But again, oysters are spawners for one thing, and triploids are not allowed to release egg and sperm and divide. They just don't have that ability to do that. So they're simply there to, you know, either feed the crabs or feed somebody else, you know, to barbecue. So.
They're like drones.
Any other questions? Great. Thanks very much. We'll take our last panel on this bill. Kurt Melcher. Joe Rolletter. And Terry Witt. Kurt, I called your name first. You want to start?
Sure. Thanks, Chair Cannon, Chair Gillian, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I did provide a very brief written testimony here as well today. I want to start by saying that the department has adopted both rules and policies related to transgenic fish
and the release of transgenic fish in Oregon's waters. We strictly basically prohibit that. We have no programs at any of our fish hatcheries that involve genetic engineering or recombinant DNA or RNA techniques. However, I do want to mention that we do have very large triploid trout production programs, both public programs and through the purchase of triploid products from private aquaculture in Oregon. The confusion that you've heard today regarding triploids is also of a concern to us. We believe that triploid trout are a very important part of our business portfolio, if you will, and in our ability, and really enhances our ability to protect our native fish populations through the use of these triploid trout. So we do have concern, and certainly would like to clarify in whatever legislation is drafted whether this does or does not apply to triploids. With that, I'm happy to answer questions. I can go through the actual mechanics of creating triploids, if you like, or not. I really leave it up to you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Krieger?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Triploid salmon, if it was to be, someone had told me they could get 200 to 600 pounds in 8 years. I think that might be a real game fish, you know.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Krieger, you know, I've heard things like that as well. I don't know. I haven't seen anything in the literature that validates that. Our focus has been on triploid trout because these they are sterile, and much of the migrational instincts in salmonid populations are driven by sexual maturation. We're fairly certain that if we can create triploid salmon, for instance, or triploid steelhead, but we think that after they go to the ocean, they will never come home, or they will just come home at random, if you will, because of the lack of, there's no sexual maturity, which then drives their instinct to return to their natal streams. So ours has been focused on trout.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Representative Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to hark back to Representative Hovey's testimony, I wanted to ask you, well, first, These terms are new to me, and I don't want to insult anybody in our committee room. Are there any sterile fish in the room? Okay, good. What about them being aggressive? Did you hear that testimony?
Chair Cannon, Chuck, I heard that testimony. I think with regard to our trout programs, and we have certainly Ms. Rollator here, as I'm sure as well, is interested in addressing the trout programs, we do see perhaps a little bit accelerated growth rates with some of our triploid trout. I don't know that they're any more or less aggressive with regard to your ability to catch them or their ability to compete with native fish populations. And again, one of the primary issues with native fish populations is either just through genetic intermixing of native and non-native stocks and or competition for spawning areas. And if we have these fish which do not ever sexually mature, they don't compete in that manner with our native fish populations.
My quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, is, so to your knowledge, there's no evidence that they are somehow beating up on our other natural fish or causing them harm?
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, at least with regard to our populations here in Oregon, not that the department is aware of.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea if the diluted gene pool has already occurred? Do we test those populations we have and say nothing's happened so far? The reason I ask arises from some discussions with scientists regarding some of the challenges facing us over in my part of the state in the plant, and whether it's alfalfa or whether it's sugar beets or whether it's these other things. And the phrase I heard was the genie's out of the bottle in regard to a number of those populations. And I just wonder if we really know if it's already happened here.
Sure, Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Representative Vance. I think with regard to our native trout populations, we have not seen any indication of trend influence or impacts from any genetically engineered fish. Certainly, we've not seen any impacts from our triploid trout programs on natural fish populations. There's always the chance that there's been some, genetic influence from non-native trout stocks that have been released, and in some areas we actually have species that are not native that are in various water bodies. And so, obviously, you could argue that in that case, the genie is out of the bottle. We've got brook trout in various water basins. We've got brown trout, both of which are not native to Oregon, in a number of basins, including the Owyhee over in your area. Clearly, that genie is out of the bottle. But that's not related to genetic engineering. Those are just simply different species that were introduced within the state.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I guess, how would we know? That's my question. How would we know? And when you say you haven't observed it, do you test genetic modifications, or is it merely an observation of the numbers?
Yeah. Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Representative Vance, we certainly have done some genetic testing on individual populations around the state. Not aware of any indication of transgenic fish impacts in those basins. But then also, just through a little professional judgment on behalf of our staff, no one's indicated to us that we have an issue with transgenic fish in Oregon.
I have a follow-up. Mr. Chair, this is a question of relativity, I guess, and relative danger to our populations. And this, I have no idea how big a problem this could be if we didn't have this law. I have no idea. Does it measure up to the type of damage that can be done by some of the invasive species that we have? Where on the level of big fears does it fit?
Sure. Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Representative Vance, certainly it is a concern, and the Commission has adopted both policy and rules regarding the release of transgenic fish in the waters of the state. It is, in rule, currently prohibited. So I would say genetically engineered fish released in the state waters are something that we would consider a very real threat. It has not occurred to date, but we have actually adopted policies and rules that prevent that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's hear from our last two folks who signed up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollater. I'm here today representing Desert Springs Trout Farm, which is a large trout producer in eastern Oregon. We have artesian water. We grow trout that are not subject to any diseases. They don't carry any pathogens. For about 5 years now, we've been growing triploid trout. And about 3 years ago, we converted exclusively to triploid trout. Many of the contracts that we get from other states, like California, specify that our trout have to be triploid. And we have trout in our hatchery that are 3 to 5 years old that are triploid, and we see no evidence that they are aggressive or that they become sexually mature in any way. Now, we buy the eggs already turned into triploids from Trout Lodge, which is a big producer in Washington that has a brood stock that produces these fish. As I understand it, there's a big difference between the process that turns a trout egg into a triploid egg and this transgenetic frankenfish that we're all afraid of. So, as I understand it from going up to Trout Lodge and talking to the farm, a girl fish has two chromosomes and a boy fish just has one. When they combine in the wild, somehow one of those chromosomes gets kicked out. And so there are just two chromosomes left in the mating part of the animal. Whereas, if you subject the egg just after it's been fertilized to either heat or pressure, it's rendered sterile because the third chromosome that's normally in nature kicked out of the system, it stays in the trout. So it has three chromosomes. Now, when I saw this bill and a companion bill in the Senate, I asked Kurt Melcher here, to ask their scientists if triploid trout that are produced the way we produce triploid trout in both the state and private hatcheries would come under this bill. And the scientists told us no. I think there may be some confusion about what transgenic fish are. The fish that we've all heard about, that we read about in the New York Times, is a Chinook salmon egg that's had a gene from a bunch of genes from a goby, which is this little animal that lives on the bottom. It's about that long. It's really ugly. But it feeds year-round. And so they've taken a Chinook salmon, and they've artificially inserted a series of genes from this other fish so that they'll feed year-round. Our fish, our triploids, and I'm sure these transgenetic fish, grow very rapidly. And we convert food very efficiently. 1.2 pounds of food produces 1 pound of fish. And in the wild, it's much different than that. So while Desert Springs Trout Farm is very interested in maintaining the integrity of all the wild fish in Oregon, we do everything we can to prevent invasive species from being transferred into our hatchery. It would really ruin our operation if we got any kind of invasive species or transgenetic species into our hatchery. But we think triploids are a really good idea. They're sterile. They don't try to spawn in the wild. So thank you very much.
And can I just clarify that if this bill was amended to clearly not affect triploid fish, you would support it, or you would be... I don't mean to put words in your mouth, so I guess that's
Mr. Chair, I talked to our president last night, and he said they definitely would support it if triploid fish were excluded from the coverage of the bill.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Mr. Witt.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name's Terry Witt. I'm executive director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I have to say that as the bill is written, OFS is opposed to this bill. It's a very confusing bill, and it's very, I pardon the expression, but it's very poorly written if, in fact, the intent of this bill is to stop the release of transgenic fish only in the state of Oregon. I think as number one was first mentioned, or mentioned by actually the Fish and Wildlife representative here at the dais, that there already are statutes on the books. And matter of fact, it's shown here in Section 3 of the bill that it is not, they have the ability to and the policy for stopping the release of genetically engineered fish. So if that law is already on the books and it's already the policy of the Fish and Wildlife Department that they are not going to release genetically modified fish, one has to start wondering, well, maybe some of these other drafting situations in the bill are not simply drafting mistakes but intentional. For example, if you note in the definition, genetically engineered is not just transgenic modifications to fish, but it says genetically engineered means having genetic structure at the molecular or cellular level altered by other means that are not possible under natural conditions or processes. It doesn't say anything about transgenic types of operations. So number one, the scope that this would potentially encompass, I think, goes far beyond what would be called transgenic or recombinant DNA types of techniques. Number two, I have to differ with Representative Holvey's characterization that this only deals with waters, specific waters of the state. If you read the definition on lines 19 and 21, it says any body of water in the state. And that's very clear. Does not say waters of the state. It says any body of water in the state. I think that would be totally encompassing of all waters other than aquaria that are exempted out in section sub 3. The other part of the bill that bothers me is that if you look at what it prohibits is the import into transportation within the state of any genetically engineered fish or shellfish. What that would also prohibit is the transport of fish or shellfish food into the state. It doesn't say anything about these being live organisms. So this would be the equivalent of, in my reading of this bill, a prohibition of even bringing in genetically modified foods of the fish or shellfish type, including things like cat food. I guess in closing, I'll leave it at that. I think this bill goes well beyond what it appears to be on the surface, the way it's written. And the other thing that is very problematic is, yes, there are debates going on currently within the Food and Drug Administration about whether or not to approve a genetically modified salmon, in this case one that's being requested to be raised in the state of, I think it's Massachusetts, known as a Aqua Advantage. And it is a salmon that grows about twice as fast as a conventional salmon. Those debates are going on right now within FDA as to, number one, is that food safe to eat? And I think basically the determination has been made that, yes, the food is probably safe to eat. Then the question becomes one of what are the potential impacts on environment, if any, and are there any labeling requirements that should be imposed so that at least the consuming public would have the ability to differentiate. Those debates are going on right now, and I don't see the advantage of passing a bill that is duplicative of authorities that are already enforced by the Department of Fish and Wildlife in doing so in advance of what's happening on the national level. I think those kind of activities would further put Oregon at a disadvantage and potentially really impact our food processing industries as well. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Mr. Wick, could you describe what activities are you concerned that this bill would restrict or eliminate are going on now in the state of Oregon? So put aside a triploid. Let's say somehow we dealt with that. And let's say we're only talking about the importation of live fish or shellfish, because I assume, and I agree with you, the wording there would appear to potentially encompass fish products,
right.
But let's say it was amended to mean live fish or shellfish. What activities going on now would be affected by this bill that concern you?
Mr. Chair, I guess I can answer that question with a question, and that is what activities are going on that need to be regulated now that aren't being regulated? I see no reason to pass regulation for the sake of regulation other than I think This is a great example of, pardon the expression, but fear-mongering. You heard several people use the term Frankenfish. That is a term that's used intentionally to invoke fear of the unknown. I think the folks that are at this particular dais right now are well aware of activities that are going on right now that are not creating problems. And I think the Fish and Wildlife Department is doing a very good job of regulating any activity that this bill would regulate. I believe they already have the authority to do that and have demonstrated over the course of a decade or more that they are more than willing to do that.
Thank you. Great. With that, seeing no one else to testify on this bill, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3314. And open our final bill, public hearing on House Bill 3203. And Mr. Romaine, Mr. Peterson, you're the only two on the list. Why don't you both come up?
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to not repeat what I did the other day in committee and sit up here and let these two very capable people carry the load.
Thank you, Representative Boone. This is your bill, and Liz, you want to give us a quick summary? I always forget to do this.
Yeah.
Somebody just needs to poke me and elbow me and remind me that,
that
she's
permission.
Supposed to read the summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3203 would require the Department of Environmental Quality to study certain efficiency issues relating to the implementation and enforcement of state, federal, and environmental laws, and to provide a report to the legislature on that study on or before November 1st, 2011.
Great. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. So I'm going to speak very generally about efficiency work in the agency and some of the other things that hopefully will give you some perspective, and then we'd certainly answer any questions. I am passing around a sheet that will show some of the work that we're doing. And I certainly appreciate the desire to learn more about the work we do and how it is funded. My belief certainly is that good government needs to be about delivering service in the most efficient manner. And we're continually working on those efficiencies and implementing efficiencies at DEQ. And that's the fact sheet that I'm handing out that describes what we're doing at DEQ to be more efficient with our process. We started this back in early 2009, where we're really investing in trying to save time and steps in our process to deliver that more efficient process, and it's paying off quite well in terms of finding those efficiencies. And I'm not going to go through that sheet. It's just for your information. We're continually working on that. I might also mention one thing that we're doing related to this is we're expanding this outside of just DEQ, whereby we did have a policy package for a fee increase in the 401 program, which is to certify clean water projects, and it's quite a complicated process. We chose to pull that back and work with other agencies and do a similar process to find those efficiencies so that we can, in fact, work together and deliver that service in a more efficient way. So I'm excited about that, and we're just doing that. So that's good work to try to really find those efficiencies and save money. Certainly, there's always questions about what drives work at our agency. The primary driver is federal law. Oregon, like Washington, California, and many other states, are delegated responsibility for implementing federal programs. Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, as examples. Much of what we do is rooted in that delegation, such as writing permits. And in some cases, we will transfer implementation of that delegation to other agencies. The prime example is with Oregon Department of Agriculture. They implement the confined animal feeding operation, CAFO program, which is a Clean Water Act program. In addition, we implement many requirements that are developed under state law that are not federally required. For example, we have a state groundwater protection program. The solid waste program is another one that was founded in state requirements to meet statewide waste management goals. And the environmental cleanup program is a state program that cleans up sites that are contaminated from legacy pollutants. And the septic system program, which protects public health and ground surface water, state-only programs. We also take drivers from the legislature, whether it be approval of policy packages for funding certain things, as well as like legislative approved key performance measures, which look at what's the direction that we're driving with some of this stuff. Certainly, we develop rules for the Environmental Quality Commission that implement federal and state requirements, as well as legislative-driven policy issues that are there to provide specificity in terms of implementation. Also, the agency may take on policy-related actions. An example would be under the Groundwater Protection Act. We're directed to develop groundwater management areas where there's potentially problems, to designate those areas and come up with a reduction plan. So it's just a mixture of a whole number of different things. Certainly, the question of funding comes up a lot, especially now in this difficult economic time, we're certainly challenged in funding in a number of different ways. The federal government provides about 17% of our budget, of our operating budget, which is far less that's needed to operate many of the delegated programs that we have. Therefore, DEQ and the state rely on other funds. About 66% of our budget is other funds, and mostly it's fees to deliver services that are expected from those that we regulate. About 14% of our operating budget is from the general fund, and that's been allocated over the years for various programs. One example is our water quality permitting, and some of our air quality permitting is a mixture of federal fee and general funds. This is typically done through discussion with stakeholders leading to legislative action, whether it's our budget or policy option package and that sort of thing. One specific example is Senate Bill 45 in 2005 implemented an agreement with a number of stakeholders that continued the commitment to use fees and general funds for the water quality permitting program. And to round out our funding, we get about 3% of our operating budget from a lottery funds that's primarily used in the water program. There's a whole lot of detail about each and every program we operate at DEQ, and I'm more than willing and pleased to provide any information on all of those programs as you see fit. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, just sort of giving some perspective as it relates to this bill.
Thank you, Director Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions before we...
And I just, you know, found out this week, this is for you, Dick, that Clatsop County has now has a named federal site. What is it called? A Superfund site. And just wondering, will the federal government provide funding for that? Or is that something that you guys are going to have to come up with?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Co-Vice Chair Boone, yes, just recently the federal EPA announced that two sites that are proposed for federal EPA listing, one is the Astoria Marine site where there's some contamination out there, and another one is Northwest Ridge Estates down in Klamath Falls. They're very different sites. And it depends. The federal Superfund program or NPL listing will depend on if there's a viable, responsible party. Then EPA would direct that party under their laws to do it with their money. If they're not able or don't have the funds, then EPA could very well use what's called the federal Superfund, which is the money that is used to clean up. And it's just a mixture. It depends on the sites.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill suggests two different questions. One's the efficiency of the department. The other is the part about our centers being greater than those required by the federal law. When one sees a bill like this, one wonders why we would ask the department itself to be its own reviewer. And what other alternatives are there other than ask the department to tell us how good a job it's doing? Is it a situation where there's some group out there that comes in and tells us that you're doing a great job, or is it efficiency-wise? I'm just curious, from your involvement in as an agency head, if there are other means of trying to answer the questions posed by this bill, other than just asking the department. That's my question. Are you aware of other means of measuring your efficiency, other means of measuring whether you exceed that which the federal government's asking?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, sort of processing the question a little bit, but we certainly get a lot of feedback from Oregonians through the process, whether it's a stakeholder process or whatever, to look at, number one, whether it be efficient or whether we are adopting rules or being driven from the legislature to implement something that's more restrictive than federal standards. And a lot of that doesn't necessarily come, or a lot of it doesn't come from the agency. It might be coming from whether it's pressure or desire to do more. I don't know if that answers your question. A lot of it is driven by a number of different factors.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The The question, of course, we've had a similar situation come up in school districts and other places where you want to know how good a job you're doing. So you ask some third party to come in and give you like a performance audit.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, yes, we ask some high-powered, expensive group to come in, do a complete study of the whole department, come back with a report this thick, and tell you something.
Right.
And I'm just asking, what are the other approaches other than asking the department itself to grade itself? That's what I see here.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, my quick response is that is our programs financially get audited by the Secretary of State often. That happens a lot, and we do well in that regard.
Yeah, performance audit, I said, not a number.
Not
audit.
Financial audit. We do surveys of Oregonians. We could have someone come in and evaluate our program. On the federally delegated programs, EPA watches us and audits our programs, whether we're delivering on that. I think there could be a number of ways to look at department program efficiencies.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
I applaud you for the results you've shown here, but I think I'm missing something. Why do you need a statute to operate more efficiently? And if that's the case, do we need to have the same statute for every other agency?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Thompson, this isn't a department bill. So I'm just here to respond to this.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry if that was...
The light comes on.
Right.
The light comes, yeah. But man, if we could get every agency to come in and ask for the right to be efficient, we're on to something. You know?
Maybe it should be.
Yes. Well, there was I was going to recommend this huge increase in salary for you, but...
No. Could I rephrase?
You're going to work for the salary now.
No.
Paul.
Excuse me. Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committees. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland. I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association, and actually this bill idea was sort of mine and Representative Boone, who is my second state representative. I'm all over the place, so I have a second state representative. So we were conspiring one day and actually came up with the idea. The genesis of this was a frustration, if you would, with what's called vapor recovery. And just without going into a lot of detail, what happened was the feds passed a requirement where we had to do vapor recovery on gasoline, basically. So when it's put into a tank, storage tank, basically you have to have equipment to make sure that the vapor doesn't escape. No, that's good. That's a good thing, by the way. Not questioning it. The Fed standard was anybody doing more than 100,000 gallons a month. And it was going to be enforced by it could be enforced by the feds. The state had the option of taking over the enforcement and chose to do so and published a proposed rule to go down to require every station that was pumping 10,000 gallons or more a month to, in effect, have to put in this vapor recovery equipment. Now, this is very expensive equipment. And just because gas prices are high, we don't make much money in the retail gasoline business, or, frankly, even in the wholesale gasoline business. If you have wells in the ground, you are probably doing quite well. We, unfortunately, here don't have wells in the ground. So all these expenses start adding up. And we worked with DEQ. They went through their process, and they, after us telling them that they were basically going to drive everybody with a small station out of business, if they required this, they raised the amount up to 40,000 gallons per month. And the requirement now in Oregon is any station with 40,000 gallons or more per month has to have this equipment. Now, we're only I think there are one other state, Florida, that requires this, anybody to be lower than the federal requirement. So we had that question. The second one was the original rationale behind doing this was the fact that our gasoline, because of the source of it, was higher in benzene than other gasolines. But thanks to Senator Wyden, frankly, at the federal level and some moves, our gasoline is slowly coming down in benzene content. Going there's a sort of national average. We're still probably a little bit higher, but we're not anywhere close to where we were before. The justification kept changing. And now we're stuck with this situation, and frankly, the stations that are open all put in the equipment because it's required and everybody's in compliance. But again, it costs a lot of money for a station to put this stuff in, which is fine if you're pumping enough gasoline through that station. But if you're a marginal operation, which tends to be in the rural areas, it can force you out of business. So if you're wondering why you have to drive 50 miles or 100 miles to find a gas station and why the price of gas is so much higher at that station that's not pumping very much, it's because of all the different requirements. What this prompted in my discussions, and I don't even think there was any intoxicating liquor involved in our discussions at the time, and we were just, what programs are there out there at agencies, and the one we picked on was DEQ, and let me just as an aside, working with DEQ is actually a pleasure. The folks there are very nice. We battle all the time over all types of things, but we have a very good relationship. It's they're good to fight with, and they're good to work with, frankly. But it's what...
Is there any intoxicating... No.
I'm going out for some right after this, after I make that statement, but no. But we work very well with everybody over there, even when we disagree with them. This is not a bash at the agency. It's what are we doing here? Are we actually doing things that we can have somebody else do? Is there a need to actually go lower in certain instances? There are a lot of programs where, frankly, the industry here will pay for DEQ to do it rather than the feds. They want them to do it, but when talking with Representative Boone, it came to, we need to know what those programs are. What are the programs out there that we're doing in this particular agency that are mandated by the feds, and the feds will actually do, but we've chosen to take them over? Why did we choose to take them over? What kind of money is it costing to do this program? How much more does it cost your businesses here to do this? And this isn't an attempt to put a box around the agency or anything, or restrict the agency. It's just an attempt to know what it is. And yes, the agency probably is the best place to start to tell us, to give us the inventory. What are the programs out there? What do we have out there? What can we look at? And you, as a legislative body, maybe take a look and say, well, you know, we don't really need to be doing this. We could cut a little cost here or there, be a little more efficient if we didn't have this particular requirement or that particular requirement. Because, frankly, the vapor recovery requirement came without any kind of legislative authorization. It's a general authorization. They do the program. It's their decision through rule to do it. And it costs us a lot of money to comply, at least the lower volume stations. It costs them a lot of money. Frankly, the bigger stations and the newer stations were putting it in anyway. But, and they would have to under the federal law. That's the intent of the bill. We think it's a good thing to do, and frankly, with any agency. What are the programs we're doing periodically? Come back to us. Tell us, why are we doing these programs? Is this something that the local businesses actually want? That's a good thing. Is this something that we need to be stricter because there's a particular problem here in Oregon where we're unique? Or is this just something we're doing, frankly, that we can maybe slide off to somebody else? Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Main. Any questions? All right.
I just wanted to tell Representative Gilliam that I could spell my name.
I see no one else to testify. Mr. Peterson, any final thoughts?
No, I'm happy to describe Chair Cannon to the committee anytime about the programs, what we're doing, and certainly willing to do that.
Great, thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3203 and adjourn the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thank you, members.
Okay, sure.